Do you remember that old adage, it doesn't matter whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game? It can almost seem as if a reverse sentiment holds sway these days. It doesn't matter what you do, as long as you win. And after all, it underlines the drugs in sports scandal, match fixing, also in other areas of our lives, in schools and universities where results are deemed more important than the love of learning, and in politics where you sense that conventions are laid aside in order to win. And of course, we've already mentioned banking this morning on Saturday Extra. According to my next guest, Margaret Heffernan, it doesn't have to be this way. And there are other people who've worked this out too and are making collaboration the new C word, not competition. Margaret herself has worked in a myriad of professions, from producing BBC documentaries, buying and selling internet companies, advising senior executives. She's also an author, and she makes her case about the adverse effects of competition in her latest book, A Bigger Prize, Why Competition Isn't Everything and How We Do Better. And Margaret joins me, I'm delighted to say, from England. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thanks very much, Geraldine. It's good to be talking to you.
It's not really, Margaret, until you read all the detailed case studies in your book that one sits back astonished at how much there is around us. When did you first become aware of it and how you think it's inhibiting us?
Well, in my last book, Willful Blindness, I had interviewed a banker at a Midwest bank in the United States about why the bank had gone into subprime mortgages. And he told me an interesting thing, which was, he said, you know, we realized that subprime was a really terrible product and that it ripped off poor people. But we're in a competitive marketplace for salespeople. And we knew that if we couldn't sell these high commission products, that we would lose our sales force. And after I'd finished that book, that particular conversation really stuck in my head because I thought, hang on a second, this isn't the way competition's supposed to work. According to classic economic theory, competition is supposed to produce a wide variety of choices for consumers, which both makes life more interesting, but also diversifies risk. And yet in the banking crisis, what we saw was that it proved to be so catastrophic because, in fact, all the banks had done exactly the same thing. So I thought, are there other conditions or situations where competition doesn't work the way we've all been told it works? And what I discovered was pretty staggering. I mean, it definitely surprised me and made me look at competition in a whole different way.
Well, in fact, you came to the conclusion, and you, I think, back it up myself, that it is counterproductive in terms of bringing innovation to the fore, that a majority of people in your analysis in the organisations with strict ranking, they actually want to be in the middle. They don't want to stand out and be in the top percentile and be under all the stress. And that it leads to a sort of mediocrity. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. A very large proportion of the biggest companies in the world use a system called forced ranking. And forced ranking assesses everybody and puts them in a bell curve. So it develops and promotes the top 10%. It throws out the bottom 10%. Jack Welch, the CEO of GE, called this a kindness because clearly they weren't thriving. And the people in the middle fundamentally kind of hunker down because they can see that being on either edge of this bell curve is a pretty stressful place to be. So, of course, the safest place is safely in the middle where you don't do or say anything out of line. You're kind of nice and friendly to people and you do what has to be done, but you never put yourself at risk by offering anything kind of remarkable or noticeable. And I interviewed lots of people who work for very famous companies who manage this way. One of them was Microsoft, one of them is Intel. And you look at these companies, and these are companies which will tell you at the same time that they have a significant innovation problem. And they just completely fail to see the connection between the two. Now, what's really interesting is, of course, if you're in the top 10%, you think life is great. So I had a conversation with a very senior guy at Intel who just didn't see the problem with this system. And I said to him, well, of course you don't, because it's been fine for you, and you're way too lofty now to see the incredible kind of disengagement and lack of interest when people are in the middle, because you never even meet those people. Towards the end of writing my book, Microsoft very interestingly announced that it was abandoning this process. Microsoft is involved in a lot of internal strategic reflection and very much aiming to create what it calls one Microsoft, to get rid of silos, to get rid of internal competition. And I think the first major step it took towards doing this was abandoning its forced ranking system. And of course, Microsoft, you know, for all that it's a terrific and amazing and huge software company, has had a significant innovation problem in the sense that it missed the internet, it missed mobile computing, it missed search, you know, it missed social networking. You know, major technology trends which you would expect a company of that caliber to be on top of.
In this Microsoft story, which I found so interesting, top-notch developers didn't want to work with other strong performers because doing so would risk their ranking. And they actually walked to other companies where they were in a more, well, it was obviously a more benign environment where they felt they could produce their better work. So this was completely interesting, you know, fascinating.
That's exactly right. And, you know, everybody who's looked at Microsoft for years has said this notion that by pitting people against each other, you get the best from them is just completely wrong. And yet, you know, we run companies like this. We run our education system like this. In many ways, I would say we run our social structures like this. And I kind of understand why people might think it would work, but overwhelmingly the evidence is that it doesn't.
Unless you're Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, where it does seem to work.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you look at the extraordinary scale of billion-dollar fines that J.P. Morgan Chase has had to pay in the last year, I think you could argue that it has had some very perverse outcomes indeed. When I talk to my business students, I'm really stunned by the degree to which nowadays the best and the brightest of them do not want to go into financial services. 10 years ago, that's where they all wanted to go. I work with some of the very big audit firms, and one of the things that's really striking there is that their young recruits don't like to tell people where they work. Now, that's a really...
How long has this been happening? Because we've been tracking this, and it was just starting to happen a couple of years ago, but you're really noticing something now, are you?
Well, I certainly, in my MBA students, notice an absolute sea change, you know, that now they all want to be entrepreneurs. But the fact of the matter is that we do need the financial services industry to work functionally, and that means we need good people to go into it. And, you know, and while everybody kind of likes to beat up on bankers, the truth of the matter is we really need this industry to work in order for other industries to work.
Is there a perfect blueprint then, let me ask you another way, for collaboration? Is that what you found?
Well, I think it's really interesting. I've written about many fantastically collaborative companies, very, very successful companies and very innovative companies around the world. Companies like W.L. Gore, Ocean Spray, TechShop, Ripple. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And I think there is no absolute blueprint. They all do it somewhat differently. What you do see, however, across all of these different kinds of businesses is a high degree of trust. You see high degrees of flexibility and autonomy in the way that people work. So, for example, at W.L. Gore, you're deemed to be a leader if you call a meeting and people want to turn up. In other words, if they want to work with you.
Well, look, I'm not aware of W.L. Gore. What business are they in?
So W.L. Gore is one of the most innovative high-tech engineering firms in the world. I mean, they have this vast and immensely sophisticated range of really cutting-edge products. And they keep their business units deliberately small. So a business unit rarely gets beyond about 150 people. And if the business is expanding, they'll create another unit at a different site. But one of the reasons that they do this is that they believe that part of what makes the company successful and part of what makes it a place where people want to do their best is because it's a society in which everybody knows one another. So they're very deliberately building what people call social capital, which are things like trust and reciprocity, knowing your neighbor, and so on. And that level of trust and the removal of stress from the workplace is one thing that really galvanizes people's imagination.
I wonder if I could ask you then, are there any times have you discovered when competition is necessary? Like in the media world, for instance, you know, Rupert Murdoch's great creative tension thing. I'm not saying I support it, but there is that sense of competitiveness driving people to lift themselves and go that extra mile. What do you think?
Well, I'd say Rupert Murdoch's creative tension is what led directly to phone hacking, so not a big fan. What I think is competition is fantastic for really dull, boring tasks. You know, if you have to stuff a million envelopes, it's much more fun to turn it into a race than to just sit there and try to do it brilliantly, you know, because it's a dull, boring, repetitive exercise. But I think, in fact, what happens is most people, if you create the right conditions, want to come to work, they want to do their best, and they want to grow. To the degree that you create a competitive environment, you constrain the things that they think about, because they're thinking about the target. So now their whole range of thought has been narrowed. They feel under quite a lot of stress. They may not like that stress, in which case, you know, they'll just kind of keep their head down and try to avoid the contest altogether. They'll have a real fear of losing, and there is nothing in the psychology literature that suggests that people do their best work, especially their best creative work, when they're afraid. So I think that in terms of innovation, creativity, productivity, and dedication to work, I think competition is probably one of the most profound demotivators I've ever seen.
Well, you also make the point that the media tends to praise the solo heroic performer as opposed to good systems, and that actually it constantly eulogizes those who are competitive and successful, but doesn't focus on the failures amongst that group.
Well, I think this is quite interesting. So we have a sort of cliche, you know, especially in the business press, that successful companies are always attributed to one heroic solo leader. And there are several difficult issues around this. One is that it's been shown that the CEOs who feature most often on magazine covers, that these people are more likely to pursue very aggressive strategies, most notably among with mergers and acquisitions, which in turn creates a much more volatile stock performance. So what happens is that as you promote these people into kind of heroes and demigods, they feel incredible pressure to do something to justify that status, which makes the company inherently less stable. And I would argue that, you know, one great example of this is John Brown, who was for many years the much lauded CEO of BP, known among the business as the sun god, or the sun king, who of course built BP into a super major by lots and lots of mergers and acquisitions. That created lots of debt. The debt led to lots and lots of cost cutting, 25% per year for 4 years, which is directly implicated in the 11 deaths in 2005 at the Texas City refinery and in 2008 at Deepwater Horizon.
May I say you also cite your own family?
Yes. Well, I think that's where I probably, you know, in retrospect, that's probably when I first started wondering about these things, which is, you know, I had a deeply competitive father who would go into negotiations. He was a negotiator in the oil and gas business. And when I would ask him, you know, over the dinner table, what was the goal of the negotiation, he would say to break his opponent's spine. And the fact that I remember that with such lucidity, I think, suggests, you know, what a shocking thing it was.
Was he, quote, successful?
His notion of a winning negotiation was you just devastated the other side.
But was he successful in the typical way?
Well, yes and no. He got so far and no further. And he was a brilliant guy. But as soon as the company could retire him, they did retire him, which he found personally devastating. And he went on to have a career as a soloist, which was, you know, reasonably successful. But I think the fact is that anyone less successful than himself, he thought, wasn't worth spending time with. And anyone more successful than himself, he competed with so ferociously that he wasn't any fun. So actually, he ended up being quite lonely.
Oh, Margaret, it's most provocative. Has it changed you, writing this?
Definitely. I mean, I think every book I've ever written has changed me. I think maybe this one has changed me most. Partly it's made me more alert to competitiveness in myself. And it certainly sensitized me to the competitiveness I see around me. And I would say it's made me much better at diffusing it. So when I see meetings or conversations which turn into kind of one-upmanship, I tend now to move in quite quickly to diffuse it. And the best way to diffuse it is with immense generosity, to recognize that the people who are doing the one-upmanship are feeling under a lot of pressure. And the more generous you can be to them, the more you can ratchet down the conversation. And then it becomes a lot richer.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Well, so have I. Thanks very much for calling me up, Geraldine. I appreciate it.
Margaret Heffernan, entrepreneur, CEO and writer, and her book, A Bigger Prize, is published by Simon & Schuster.